You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
Hello, November. Where has the year gone? Welcome to the sixth episode of HR Bandit. If you're new here, I am so glad you found the pod. If you're returning, welcome back for what can only be referred to as our best lineup till date. This episode, we're going back in time and picking up topics that have been under discussion for at least the last 10 years, if not more. First up, pay transparency. My earliest memory of this is when Buffer opened their pay to public, I think back in 2013. With Glassdoor blind and innumerable more discussing pay, is it time for organizations to finally take this a little more seriously? Next up, data security. EU made giant leaps forward when they wrote down the GDPR in 2016-17 and made it applicable as of May 2018 for all member states. However, instead of waiting for legislation, should organizations be setting tone on how data is managed? For our last topic, innovation as a result of spontaneous discussions. The biggest argument against remote work is now up for debate on this episode. How does one translate spontaneous hallway collisions online, and to what extent will innovation be impacted? We've discussed this briefly before, but we're now going to get into it a little more. With that, let me introduce you to our guest for the episode. I'm so excited. The one and only Abhijit Bhaduri. For those who haven't heard this name before, where have you been hiding? Abhijit is a talent management practitioner with global experience across various sectors. He was the chief learning officer of Wipro and an alumnus of Microsoft, PepsiCo, Colgate, Tata Steel, and, well, the list is endless. He is also the only author we've ever had on the show with five books to his name, a mix of both fiction and nonfiction. Now, that is rare. Abhijit, welcome to the show, and how are you doing today?
Oh, thank you so much, Ankita. It's so lovely to talk to you.
I know. I'm really excited to have you. I remember your message after my first ever pod. And you know how it is when things are new? Every feedback is so valuable. So I have to say thank you for that.
No, I was, just simply dropping you a hint and hoping that it's going to sort of say that, okay, but can you please have me as a guest and see it worked? So
it
thank you
did.
So much.
But even if it wouldn't, like, you had to be on the show. And because you are the only author here, I have to ask, tell me about the blood, sweat, and tears that go into writing a book. I know some people claim for it to be easy because there's a story else inside of you just waiting to be poured out. The other thing I'm also curious about is what's easier for you to write? Is it fiction, nonfiction? What takes less time?
So I think, your first part of the question is absolutely valid. It takes three things to write, anything: blood, sweat, and tears. Blood, because, you sort of really have to connect up with, ideas and many different sources. So, till the time that you're really sort of exhausted and there are no more possibilities, because with each idea you try to explore a white space. So that's the blood part of it. Sweat is just the endless amount of writing and rewriting, when you are sort of going through the act of writing out something. It's a very lonely process. You just lock yourself up and then write, even if you have the idea in your head, which is a starting point, but then you still need to write it down, and that takes a lot of effort, and it's a lonely process. So, that's completely different from the first phase where you're meeting people, bouncing ideas, reading up different things, all of that. The tears part of it is, when you finally finish writing the whole thing, you're exhausted and you're hoping that, people are going to read the book and like it. And even the slightest kind of, hint that, oh, my God, somebody has not read it yet, you kind of say that maybe because they don't really like it. And that's always my first conclusion, it's blood, sweat, and tears, but it's something which is nevertheless very fulfilling, very addictive, and which explains why you keep going back for punishment all over again.
Oh, I can imagine. And which one's easier, fiction, non-fiction?
You know, there are two different processes. You can't say that is it easier to play an indoor game or an outdoor game, or, you know, cricket or hockey. It's really like that. It's difficult to compare because in fiction, the challenge comes from writing. For me, I believe the biggest challenge is in writing the dialogue, because you have to, if you have, you know, whatever, 10 characters, to be able to create 10 different voices so they don't all sound like you. That's the tough part. In nonfiction, you have the flexibility that you can actually, you know, talk in your own voice, and that's what is what people are looking for. But at the same time, I think you need a lot more structure in writing fiction, whereas in nonfiction, you need structure. Whereas fiction is a lot more, you have the opportunity to be a little more free-flowing. You have a little more idea to, you know, change moods and do all that. So two different methods altogether, but great fun. Certainly recommend it.
I know, and there's so many people I meet who are like, I am an aspirational author, but like everyone's like the discipline it takes to actually sit down and write an entire book. Like it's a lot of pages. It's just, I don't know if it's a good thing or bad, because we're not flooding the world with books. But like only the ones who really have it in them are actually getting out there and writing. But with that, I'm going to transition into our first topic of the day. I think of all the three we have, this is likely my favorite: pay transparency. Now, I was brought up in a world where discussing pay was either taboo or something that was expected. So while graduating from college, you knew how much everyone got paid. When you first switched a job, you went around asking, hey, how much do you earn and how much do you not? And people were sharing that openly. But then there are other situations where I'm not just going to walk up to a person at the bar and say, hey, how much money do you make? But organizations are the only place where you can actually get fired for sharing pay. Well, some organizations, not all, maybe. But Buffer came around in my second year. They changed my mind about how pay transparency works. I went back to the website. They still have pay up there by name, which is completely unprecedented for me, at least in 2013. Now it's out there. Glassdoor has it. Payscale has it. Everyone has it. Abhijit, I'm really curious. Is pay transparency wise?
Okay, so a couple of things, you know, following the sequence in which you described it. When you're starting off, you know, in college and all, you know, it really doesn't quite matter because the ranges are not that dramatically different. In some cases, you do have the outliers who may be getting way more than the rest of the peers, but, you know, that's usually dependent on the quality of the prior experience and all that stuff. So, but if, you know, nobody has work experience, then by and large, the starting salaries are the same. So therefore, you know, it's really like saying if everybody is 5 feet tall, it doesn't matter if you ask somebody's height, and, you know, it doesn't quite matter. The second piece where you begin to start seeing differentiation comes about with skills. As people build up skills, they work with different kinds of organizations, they run through different sectors, and depending on that, I mean, the pay level changes, you know. So it's really like a long game of Monopoly. You sort of, you know, accumulate points, you kind of build a house, you can go to jail.
I love
that. All of that. Yeah. So it is that model where the differentiation starts building up. But I also think that as we look at the world of work, pay is only one of the pieces. I think the reason why the differentiation happens, besides, of course, all these factors, the, you know, the sector, the skills that you have, et cetera, all of that. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that when you share salaries within the organization among peers, or, you know, whatever, senior or junior, it is not such a radically different concept, because even in India, you know, many public listed companies have to declare, you know, salaries beyond a certain level. So they do that. But I also know that, you know, it's sort of, there are some people who every year will pull out the last 5-7 years of the reports, annual reports, and will go through painstakingly to discover and sort of put together a spreadsheet which will show you that, okay, 5 years back, you actually got a 7% increase and not 10, which I thought. So there are people for whom this differentiation matters a lot. They obsess about it. For me, I think it's important. But the reason why it is hard to pull off pay transparency until the skill and pay is visible to everybody and people can draw their own conclusions. So, for example, in sports, etc., if a Michael Jordan and I, we are playing in the same team in NBA, it's okay if he gets way more than I, because, he's like substantially better than everybody else. I mean, 6 times most valuable player, etc., all of that, greatest of all times. If you're doing that, then it's easy to say, you can describe the pay, whatever he's making. And most of the times, you know how much these guys are making. When somebody wins Wimbledon, what the prize money is. When it comes to managerial work, the work is a lot more nuanced. It's a lot more complex. It depends on multiple factors. There are projects which the company is taking a bet on, which are not going to see the light of day in the next 3 years. So it's harder to say that, what the people are doing. Some of the functions like sales is easier to understand what the people are doing. In functions like HR, that much harder. So things which are intangible, the role has got a lot of intangible factors, very hard to describe what that work is all about. And therefore, no matter whichever way you try to describe it, it tends to reek of bias and unfairness. Also because most people find it very difficult to do an accurate assessment of their own skills. So even if there is a criteria, people kind of say that, oh, I think I did better than that and I deserve more. So it's a complex process. I think it is way easier when businesses start to, rip off the bandage, put some of the base salary, etc. In India, you do have many other perks, and that sort of creates the whole differentiation game by level. And in a hierarchical society, people change their cars, people do all that.
Right.
Some of that is going away. We are moving towards a place where you'll get one particular lump sum money and you decide what you want to do with it. And so we are moving in that direction. At this point of time, in some organizations, it's still tricky because while people have a very strong point of view about what they need to be paid, they don't have that much of a point of view about how good they are in terms of their skills. So I think that's the challenge.
So there are parts I agree with, the parts that I'm still mulling over. So the part I agree with is, when it comes to skills, yes, every single person, if you tell them, are you better than average, they'll probably claim to be better than average.
Yeah, you just ask people, how many of you would consider yourself in the top 5% of drivers or communicators?
Yes.
Believe me, majority of the hands are going to go up, and which is statistically impossible. That's why.
True. But the part I'm now mulling over is, okay, so maybe we don't go to the extent of buffer where we give name and pay. But there are a lot of organizations. In fact, I don't know of many organizations who publicly, not internally and externally, talk about ranges. So saying this job family at this level, this is the range for perks, base, whatever else, other categories. Do you think that's the extent of transparency companies can start with or should start with today?
Yeah, again, as I said, that some of it is very, very cultural, because when I worked in a certain company in India and then moved up to their U.S. operations, in U.S., you have a card which actually gives you by grade, how many grades, what kind of pay ranges are there. So, yes, every time you see, you sort of look at it the first time, you gasp and say, oh, my God, that guy makes this. And then it's sort of, it's really like for the first time when you go to watch a movie which is certified adults and you're like 16 or 17, you're dying of curiosity to know what that is all about. And then when you actually go and see it and say, oh, I mean, that's such a letdown. So it's really like that. I think, hiding it gives it a kind of mystique and possibly mystery. But yeah, I mean, just, you know, telling people this is it. And so once we build a culture where feedback is, you know, routine and it's given, somebody should be able to tell you this is what is fair pay. I think people get worked up when they think it is unfair. And that has nothing to do with whether the pay is announced or not, because people will still go and ask their friends, how should you get paid? Or, you know, what was the increment you got? So it's not like they don't know. But what gets, what is unfair is always what is resisted, and, you know, people get aggravated about that. So the issue is not so much pay transparency, but about pay fairness.
And obviously, I think getting into a mindset where, like, you can accept the fact that there will be people who will be paid differently. Right now, like, we see numbers every single day, and we are like, okay, well, we'll never get as much as software engineers, but we'll live with it.
Yeah, it's, you know, there are times, because it's driven by a number of factors. I mean, there's demand supply,
exactly.
There's a certain market condition. It depends on which skill is rare in that particular company, or which is the most, you know, which adds the most amount of value, etc. Any case, if you sort of really look at it, a great programmer is almost, you know, the more complex the job, the more the top end of talent, you know, is that much better and therefore deserves to be paid that much more. So, you know, a top engineer, according to Gates' own calculation, it goes anywhere from 10x to 100x of somebody
absolutely.
Who's average, you know, and you're in a business which does exactly that. So, yes, you can make those things. In some of the other functions, it's hard to do that. But, you know, in every function, even when I worked in advertising, I mean, there was some people, copywriters, who earned the earth at that point of time, you know, because they were just so good. You know, and the clients would say that, oh, my God, I need to work with that specific person. In the world of consultants, there are people who make huge amount more. They may be providing roughly the same services. It's a combination of multiple things, the expertise, the diagnostic ability, the predictive power, the, you know, the way they engage the clients. It's many, many things. So I think it's not a straightforward equation, which is why, you know, publishing it is hard, because then you consumers spend an enormous amount of time explaining why it is like that.
Absolutely.
So I find that particular process of explaining very, very tiresome. So keep it simple. You know, get your shock over with and move on.
Perfect. And you mustn't undermine the whole equation of being at the right place at the right time.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
I'm going to move us to a second topic, which is actually related in ways, because pay ultimately is personal data. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about, what is personal data? How should HR be thinking about it? Especially because I know there's legislature that exists that tells us how we should handle such certain data. But should we wait for legislature to actually tell organizations that, or should HRs, like, I know we do have layers of confidentiality, types of data, classifications and everything, but I'm going to take an example of vaccination data. Like, we are so confused as organizations. Like, do we collect? Do we not collect? And then we look to legislature and they say, okay, they say we can't collect. Makes our job easy. We don't have to collect. Or they say it has to be mandatory. You have to collect. But what are examples, or where should we think of data differently before legislature does? But before that, everyone has a good data breach story. Avijit, I have to ask you to share one that you know.
Oh, I mean, there are so many of them, I don't know where to start. I mean, there are places where the president of a country, you know, their data has been breached, their, you know, emails have been hacked into, etc. There are stories about how nuclear reactors have been breached and that data has been used, heaven knows for what, which sometimes leaves you worried. Every other day, you know, you'll find some app or the other is going to come back and say, you know, I think that we recommend you change your password. And you know what that means, because they've had a data breach. So I think we are living in a time where data is very precious. You know, there was a time when you saw bank robberies. And one of the famous lines is that when the guy was asked, why do you rob banks? I mean, so the robber shrugs and says, that's where the money is. So I think this is the same thing with data. This is where the money is. So that's why they are going to rob it, whether you like it or not. You can secure it, but it's like saying, can you put 2 locks on your door, 5 locks on your door? Potentially, yes, of course. It's going to be, if you put 5 locks and 10 locks on your door every time you walk in and out, it's going to be a challenge. It is going to be annoying to you yourself. But then even assuming that you are happy to do it, somebody else in your family is going to flout the norms. And 3, the thief who wants to break in can jump in through the windows any which way. So, you know, and you know, we have to look at the fact that Santa Claus comes in through the chimneys. So there is no reason why, you know, so how many places you're going to lock, it's that.
Oh, yeah, and it's almost time for Santa Claus to come knocking. But anyway, bringing us back to this.
Do you believe in Santa Claus? Tell the truth.
Well, I've never gotten gifts from Santa Claus yet. Like, I've gotten from
people. See, don't believe somebody who hasn't gifted you anything.
Exactly. Like, I'm hoping this year it changes, but like, I'm going to ensure I'm not locking chimneys up. But
completely.
So if you want to steal, rob my house, you know where to get in from.
That's right.
But coming back to data, I'm going to break up my questions into a few categories. First, does HR do a good job of personal data security?
If the answer is in a yes or no, the answer is no. And it's no because this is something which is still evolving. You know, legislation is still fuzzy. The idea about what the data can be used for today is very fuzzy. Above all, you know, how do we collect that data? Assuming that, you know, getting to know somebody's, you know, blood group can make it, you know, very powerful. How do you collect it in an unobtrusive way? Do you share that thing? What choices do people make? Can they carry the data back when they go? You know, does, let's say, a misconduct which was alleged but never proved, even though the whole world believes that that happened, do you keep that on record or do you sort of swipe it clean? There are many, many fuzzy things. This, I think, is going to emerge over a span of time. Until, you know, several people, I think, as far as data privacy is concerned, we are in the experimentation stage where different prototypes are being built. And we are sort of really trying to see whether it's really, you know, something that you care about or you don't. I mean, there was a point of time when, you know, we routinely filled up a question about gender, male or female. Today, a lot of people will say, why do you want to know? And you have a choice. And in the same way, you know, there will be sensitivities that will come in about whether it's race. Should we declare it? Should we not declare it? Caste, should we ask for it? Should we not ask for it? Now, some people will say, if it's not related to the job, why do you need to know?
Exactly.
And then again, in some inclusion policy, you need to see whether your workforce is inclusive enough. So there are always contradictions and situations. I think it's a data allows you to personalize, data allows you to customize, data allows you to create delightful employee experiences. All of that depends on great data. But collecting it, keeping it safe, using it wisely, disposing it off, it's a bit like, you know, plastics. You do land up using it one way or the other, but you hope you are going to minimize those bad usages and you will dispose of that stuff in such a way that it doesn't damage the environment. I would use the same parameters for data.
And it is surprising that given the importance data has, and it's been important for a very long time, I never had a course in college that taught me the classifications or how to deal with it. On the job, there's no, like, we know that there are classifications of data, how to treat it, but you also have these people who, by mistake, send an email with a whole bunch of data to the entirely incorrect email alias. And even though you recall it, there are like traces available somewhere.
Sure.
Or you have hallway conversations where you're just like, oh, you know, say something. I don't know whether our profession or every single individual in our profession understands the baton they hold when it comes to the amount of data we already know about people. One example that I've, which is something you come across every time, like I would consider residential address as personal data that HR cannot just freely distribute as and when. But I know when COVID started, people were like, oh, we have everyone's addresses. Teams were like, managers were like, oh, I want to send a care package. And then we would be giving the entire bunch of addresses to the manager to say, here's where that everyone has sent care packages.
And you're sending care packages through a courier who now has that data that, you know, in their database forever. And then tomorrow, if it gets breached, the underworld has it forever. So, And either case, in, you know, you're using maps that has your data, that has your location. And we voluntarily give up unbelievable amounts of data every time. I mean, so it is not just what the organization needs to be aware of, but I also think that we ourselves need to sort of really start thinking. Like ever so often you go to a restaurant and they will say that, do you have a reservation? And say yes or no. And then they'll say, can I have your name? And then you say that. And then the next breath they say, I want your phone number. Why do you need my phone number? Are you going to, you know, text me while I'm having my soup? What is that for? And if you say, no, it's just, you know, for the record. What record? What are you going to do with it?
Exactly.
And when you ask three questions, the person just sort of, you know, mentally rolls up their eyes and just says, okay, get on with your soup. So I just think that we need to really ask, where do we need to give what data? And some easy practices, I mean, you know, in public domain, avoid giving out, because, you know, sooner or later, every other app which is using it, you know, they send you a notification, you get this. The best usage is that you put a fake address, which, you know, I mean, fake address, the real address, because they'll sometimes send you a link.
The PO box address.
Or you create another address which you, you know, happily dole out everywhere. But it's a, you know, so anytime somebody has that. And if somebody insists that they have that, you know, they want the phone, I always refuse to do it. I mean, I have seen, if you persist, most people give up. Because if it is not necessary, and it isn't. Because when the person says, I'll send you an OTP, and I'm going to say that I don't have the OTP because my phone is out of battery. What are you going to do? And the person will say, okay, I'll send myself the OTP and I'll tell you what it is. There you go. There is a workaround. So never give your data liberally is my very strong belief.
Big personal takeaway, because I have been giving my phone number to every single restaurant that asks for it.
Why? Because they're going
I know. It's and to anyone who knows me, they know like I'm paranoid about data security. Yeah.
Some of these home apps, you know, they will ask for the visitor's phone number. And we are happily adding every time we do it. And I tell people, please, like MyGate, when you go to visit, suppose you use that.
Yes.
It needs your visitor's phone number. Why would you want to do that? It's such a, you know, one-sided breach of privacy. Somebody who I go to visit, you know, they'll do that. Now I've learned, I tell them, don't give my number. Put your own phone number and they will send it to you because their phone number is in any case listed.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, if I live in a complex which has my gate, you know, I'm finished any which way. And that explains all the rubbish that you get on your phone. And it really is such a waste of time, you know, unsolicited messages constantly bombarding you. So minimize it wherever possible.
Okay. I'm going to ask you one last question and then move on to our next topic. But I have to ask, so there's personal education part of it. What role does HR play? So there are two parts. Like, A, we dole out millions of trainings. Should we take responsibility? Because organizations are stepping in into various spheres. Do we take the responsibility to educate employees about data security because we're being a good Samaritan? And secondly, how do we get better at this? Like, what's the one or two steps that we could take today?
I think, you know, with a number of my clients, you know, some of the projects that I've done have been around creating data strategies, which is when you ask all these questions. As an essential part of that, one talks about the ethics of collecting data. You know, what do you collect? What do you use? When do you use it? And how do you dispose of the thing? Like I said, that it's, you know, it's not biodegradable. And therefore, your data is going to stay on in that place for a very long time, and all kinds of data. So that's the whole point. That so, you know, until people become aware that how those breaches can be fatal, you know, people just don't understand what it means. So I think a lot of it is done not because people are evil, but because people genuinely don't understand how cybersecurity works. And despite knowing all this, we use all kinds of browser extensions. We use all kinds of browsers which are not safe. You know, all kinds of apps which are liberally sharing our data to all and sundry. Our voices are being recorded, our, you know, iris is being recorded, all kinds of things. Either case, face recognition, which I personally think is a terrible technology, and I have strong views about it, because it's not as if somebody asks for your permission. I mean, you just walk through a security camera in millions of places, your face is part of a global database, which billions of people are hacking. So therefore, from traffickers to all kinds of people get access to your data. So now you might say, I have nothing to hide, so I don't care. Yeah, okay. Then in which case, probably you're on one end of the spectrum, you need to move to the other.
Yeah. There's so much to pick in your response there, Abhijit. And like, this is a topic I could talk endlessly about, but because we've promised folks a third topic, I'm going to take us to our last and final topic for this episode. One can talk about this as a beaten horse, and on this spot, something related to working from home has made it a feature every single episode, and it's hard not to. But I want to focus on the whole thing. Like, every organization that's calling people back to work has, of the many points, says innovation takes place when people meet physically at a workplace. And before COVID, workplaces were being designed to enhance these collision spaces. Like, you had open spaces that didn't work. We then found other ways to do it. But we've built on the idea, which has like a lot of research and papers out there, which confirms the belief that yes, innovation or spontaneous innovation happens better when people discuss organically and not through meetings. So that's not what we're debating today. Now, if we assume all that research is true, how do we translate these spontaneous collisions to the online world? Because there's no getting away from the fact that a lot of work will now be done from behind our screens.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're looking at gathering, so for innovation to happen, let me just sort of take a step back and say, we started with, you know, my thoughts around writing, and I'm going to take the same example just to put a perfect closure on this. When you look at writing, it has two phases. One is the phase which I think most people, when they are talking about writing being extremely creative and a fun process, I think this is what they have in mind, that you get a bright idea and you say that, oh, okay, I'm going to write about the importance of data privacy in HR, and I'm going to write a book. And it just seems really a wonderful idea, and I think it is a wonderful idea. And then you kind of, you know, to really try and narrow it down, and you begin to say, I mean, so who am I writing it for? Somebody who doesn't know, or who doesn't know enough, or somebody who's an expert who is then going to use this content to, you know, distribute it? Am I doing it to build awareness? Am I doing it to sell this thing? All kinds of things, right? You begin to therefore narrow it down. Then it comes to the final and the most painful and probably the largest phase of innovation, which is actually building something. Now, that building could be building an app, it could be writing your book, it could be writing an article or post or something. And that is really hard, because that requires focused, undisturbed thing where every interaction actually sets you back by almost 23 minutes. You know, somebody taps your shoulder and says, hey, I have a quick question for you, Ankita. What about this? By the time you get back to the same older state, it takes almost 23 minutes. So, achieving flow is much easier when you are on devices, because you can just simply shut it off, right? And you can decide that, okay, I'm going to lock myself. No phones, no this, that, and the other. And today, most technology lets you do that. Your watch lets you switch off alarms in various places and all that stuff. So there are ways to do that. Having said that, I think that there is a certain magic That is undeniable when it is when you meet people in person, because besides the cognitive element of the conversation, you know, I want to brainstorm with you, which we can do today here on Zoom. We can do that. We are doing that in some sense. You and I, we are talking about our ideas. We're doing right. all of that. We can learn. We can have ideas. We can have aha moments. All that is possible. But I just think about it. You know, I sort of go back to the conferences where I've met, you know, most of my colleagues for the first time. There's no getting away from the useless social interactions. And when I say useless, I'm just saying that it isn't necessarily task-related. I don't necessarily meet you because I think I've got an agenda to fulfill. I just enjoy meeting various people and know what they're up to, and that's what it is. But it is this which actually, for me, the meaning of a conference is really not in the content, because that eventually after 2 days goes online, because, you know, what are you going to do with all that content, keeping it locked up? People will distribute it, so it'll be available. You know, the best of TED Talks, which people pay money to, right. you know, get there, it's available freely. You know, so the question is, why do people go there? They're not going there for the TED Talk per se. Yes, they are, but then the bigger portion, you know, 90% of it is really to build the connections, to meet those people, bounce an idea off somebody, you know, and just say that, hey, you know, let's meet for coffee and then tell me about what's life like with you. So I think all of it is also very important for innovation, because, you know, sometimes because you've heard somebody talk about their passion for you know, let's say journalism, and they said that, you know, this is, I've got this book and this is what I read, and it suddenly strikes me, you know, maybe 2 years later, Ankita had mentioned that book. They'd be texted and say, hey, Ankita, you remember you were talking about this? This conversation is very hard to do on Zoom or any right. electronic media.
Of course, you know, yes.
Because you have 20 people and I can't be engaging one-on-one with you any which way. In a social setting in person, it is acceptable that I will periodically say, hey, Ankita, you know, are you still, you know, doing A, B, C? We can talk about that even if it's a 1 second conversation and exchange in a crowded hall. You will see that stand-up comedians with hundreds and thousands of people sitting there in the auditorium will still wave out to say, hey, you in blue sweater, hey, good to see you. You know, so that kind of a personal connection is impossible to get. And innovation does need personal connections. So it's way better. Can you get by with it? Yes, if you do it online. Yes, but it's not the same. It's way more effective. If you do it, it takes less time. Because a lot of things around innovation is much easier when you're building something. So, you know, let's say you're creating the vaccine. It's easy to do it in an isolated way over Zoom calls, et cetera, all
right.
of that.
Yeah.
You're getting people to adopt. That's the time you want to go and talk to the people and say, hey, I've built something, you want to try it out. That needs trust. So innovation has two phases. Where there is adoption, you need absolutely, you need to connect with people.
I also, oh my God, I have like so many responses to each part of it. I think not only innovation's phases, there are different kinds of innovation. So if you know you're going to have to go out and innovate like 10 different flavors of Ben and Jerry ice creams, you're going to do that because it's a task-oriented innovation. If you develop a vaccine, you are going to come up with it. But there's so many things that are innovated in isolation, yes, but you have the famous Eureka moment where you had a discovery, not an innovation. But there are also so many discoveries and innovations when you just have a conversation and it strikes you, right? It's I think that is going to be impacted. Because you got up conferences, I also going to talk about personal preferences, right? It is very hard for me to stay focused. And this is a personal anecdote, like on calls, like unless I'm looking at a person. So I know a lot of times you have just audio calls and my mind wanders. In conferences, I have actually since the lockdown started, not attended a single virtual conference like I used to. Like I used to love the SHRM conferences. I used to turn up at all of them, tweet through it. And I haven't attended a single SHRM conference. I know they'll probably kill me for saying this after they've gone online. Because even if I'm motivated, I can't focus for more than 5 minutes. And I don't think it's being inclusive because then for people like me, they're going to have a huge trouble trying to stay focused on any kind of online conversations.
And that, you know, to build on that, I mean, I think we absorb and process information in different ways. Yeah. Some people absorb it through relationships. Some people, you know, learn through, you know, online content and they sort of take notes.
Yeah.
But look at it like this, when you're facilitating a conversation and people switch off the cameras, it's impossible to find a mental connect or energize over it. So it's a task, you do it. And I hate doing it. So I tell people, yeah, if you really are going to keep that camera off, you don't exist for me because I didn't see your face. I don't know whether you were there. And so when somebody says that, oh, you know, I attended that, it was fun. I said, maybe, you know, for me, you really are non-existent. Because you, if I have known you in the past, then it's easy to do that. But you're a stranger. I've never met you. And now we're sort of, you know, keeping the camera off. I mean, I understand that,
today,
it's become almost like a sensitive topic that, you know, what about people who don't have internet? I get all that stuff.
Yeah.
But the point of the matter is it doesn't create a great bonding. That's a reality that I live with. We'll see, you know, if there is a time when we have to wear masks and go out and that's the only way, we are doing it. But if there is a way in which we can do it, you know, without those restrictions, I would prefer that.
I have to say this has been my favorite podcast till date. I've loved the conversation and I always hate having to close it. But I think one takeaway that I have for this pod, because of our conversation today, all the three topics were so large. So I'm actually going to maybe have episodes where I do like dive deep versus do the whole, we've been for the entire year and there are like two episodes left because I'm also coming up with a bonus. We've always done like these are the top three topics of the month and discuss. But I think today I've learned that there are some topics that need like a completely dedicated session to them. So thank you for at least making me realize that. I have loved the conversation. But before I let you go, it's Halloween season. We are recording a few days before Halloween. It'll go out after Halloween. But if you had to wear a Halloween costume, what would you pick?
The invisible cloak.
What? No! No! Like, people have to see you.
No, I don't. If you can give me the chocolate without going in for it, as I'm doing right now as we speak, you can see that.
I can, you know,
you can see this. So if you can have the chocolate without going in for the Halloween costume, I'd prefer that.
Invisible cloak. Well, that doesn't exist. So I'm not letting you get away with that. Wait, I need to, in my head, I need a real costume. So because the invisible cloak does not exist, if you had to come and trick and treat and pick up sweets from my door, what would you turn up as?
I would land up with the role of a policeman whose sole warrant is to collect all the candy that you've hidden away at home. And I would sort of say that I've got a search warrant. I'm going to look for all the candy that you have. And all the chocolate that you have, especially if you have dark chocolate, it is prohibited.
Oh, I love those.
Confiscate every ounce of dark chocolate that you have had, and it's now prohibited. So I'm going to take it all away.
I might actually steal that idea. I was thinking of turning up as a pumpkin, but, well, we'll see how easy it is to get a quick costume at this point of time. With that, Abhijit, it was great to have you on the show. Are there any parting words before we let you go?
That you do such a fabulous job, Ankita, and it's been lovely chatting with you. And I wish, you know, more and more HR people were doing the kind of podcasts that you do. It's just so much fun. You make all these conversations so easy. Thank you. You've got a gift for this.
Thank you so much, Abhijit. That made my day. With that, to all our listeners, if you've been enjoying the ride and have as great comments or compliments or even brickbats, send them my way. I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, anywhere else. I'll leave a whole bunch of
links
in the show notes.
Well.
Of course, like all your LinkedIn profile, everything else, go to our show notes. Everything we talked about will be there. With that, on behalf of Abhijit, NHRDN, and myself, we are out.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. in partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline E-Systems Limited.